But let me ask the more general question to conclude this part of the talk. What about collective effects generally? Now, we don't have much information to go on, but this is one of the important questions yet to be answered. At CERN, for helium-helium, no collective effects are seen at very high energy. But here, this is a real puzzle, and I simply leave it here as something, as a challenge for Michigan State. This is probably the best facility in the world for tackling this problem. And now, let me conclude by turning to applications. I want to take only two applications because they illustrate the broader question. The first is to geophysics. Most of you know that littering the floor of the Pacific, there are manganese nodules. This is one of those nodules. This is an unusual one because it has two growth centers and they have growth rings like trees. Now, Miller at Berkeley recognized that one could use accelerators, cyclotrons, tandems, as ultra-mass spectrometers to measure the age of these materials by looking at the beryllium-10 in them. Beryllium-10 is radioactive. It has a half-life of 1.6 million years. And rather than waiting for the beryllium-10 to decay, you simply go in and look for the nucleus itself. Well, we have looked at two of them here. These are typical. This is work from our lab at Yale, where Thomas, one of our recent graduate students, did a detailed study of this. You can take little pieces in each of the growth rings, and you can measure the growth rates. These are typical. TF5 grew at the rate of 1.1 millimeter per million years. This one, R.V. Vityaz, grew at the rate of 6.7 millimeters per million years until 4 million years ago, and then something happened, and it grew much more slowly at 1.9 millimeters per million year. Now, this morning as I listened to the talks, I came away with the impression that we still had creative imagination in our field. But we have nothing at all compared to what a good geophysicist has. When you ask a good geophysicist, why did that change? The first thing that springs to mind is a giant worm about 20 meters long, apparently. And you get some marvelous theories. This technique, however, has revolutionized geophysics because it allows us to make measurements of high precision in the million-year period. It's a clock that was set ticking back when the planet was young, in many cases, and was not reset subsequently. And so it is an important technique. More important, it's a technique that illustrates if one wanted to go out and date something geophysically, certainly it would not be an obvious move to go out and build a cyclotron. But because Miller was familiar with cyclotrons, cyclotron technology, and was sensitive to the problems in other fields, in geophysics and in geology, it was only natural for him to make this application. The same sort of thing is true of the next case. One of the most difficult problems faced by the electronics industry is that of making good ohmic contacts. In fact, one of the major problems in technology is making a thin film of anything stick to anything else permanently and solidly. To give you a worst possible case, this is a block of Teflon. Nothing sticks to Teflon. We all know that. Now, this particular discovery was made by Tombrello and his colleagues at Caltech, and we are now collaborating with him on it. What happens here is you take a block of Teflon and you evaporate 500 micrograms of gold per square centimeter all over the Teflon. And then you start here, and you bombard this with 10 to the 12th alpha particles per square centimeter, 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th, and then you give it the highly technical test that's used throughout high technology industry. You put a piece of scotch tape down over it, and you rip it off. This, believe me, will test your adhesion. And what we find here is that it doesn't really adhere totally there, and it doesn't really adhere totally there, but it seems to here and here, and it doesn't adhere at all where it wasn't bombarded. And what has been found in a lot of these studies is, in fact, that you can stick anything to anything. The amount of bombardment you need depends a little bit on what projectile you use. Heavy ions turn out to be great for this. This just happened to be done with alpha particles. And you need an order of magnitude more in the way of dose as you go from insulators to semiconductors to metals. You need 5 times 10 to the 13th per square centimeter for insulators, 5 times 10 to the 14th for semiconductors, and 5 times 10 to the 15th for conductors, and you get a permanent, solid, ohmic contact. And we've now looked enough at this to know that it has nothing to do with ion beam mixing. It does not come from forming an alloy in the material. And the working hypothesis at the moment is that as the ion goes through the thin layer of metal, it forms a column of electrons that are exceedingly hot, about 12,000 degrees Kelvin. And as these hot electrons cascade down into their final states, they form an electrostatic bond which gives you the adhesion. Well, here again, if one wanted to stick a contact onto an integrated circuit, one would certainly not go out and build an accelerator. But because Tombrello was sensitive to these problems, he felt that this experiment was worth doing. And this is something that I think bears emphasis. The techniques, the concepts, the tools of our science have applications far beyond it. And those that are most successful in finding those applications are those who maintain a broad interest, not only in their own science, but across the whole frontiers of science. But let me return then to heavy iron physics, to nuclear physics. All of us here tonight are privileged indeed to join in congratulating Hank Blosser and his team here at the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory for producing a superb new facility, which, as I said at the outset, brings this nation back to many of the frontiers of this field of science. And not only that, but it introduces into this field of science a whole new technology, that of superconductivity. Looking back to 1958, it would have been difficult indeed to see and predict the tremendous growth that has taken place in our science and in our technology. But the new facility that we inaugurate tonight is indeed a worthy successor to the very fine cyclotron that Hank and his associates built back in the early 60s that has made Michigan State already one of the world's major centers in our science. And so there's a very exciting time ahead. And let me simply conclude by noting that, like so many other frontier areas of science, the great adventure of exploration into the unknown becomes possible only through a partnership between academic, state, and federal institutions. And the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory that we inaugurate tonight is an excellent example of what that kind of partnership can accomplish. Thank you.
Too bad it's so late, we really could stand an encore. It's my privilege, officially at this point, to declare the cyclotron inaugurated and to ask Dr. Blosser to come here and give you the logistics on how to get out of this place and onto the field trips. Dr. Blosser.
Well, let's see, let me say, first of all, that there will be refreshments in the outer lobby for those who prefer that to the tour. We also have to organize the tour because it's basically a one-track path through the laboratory, and if you all go at once, it'll be the longest line you've been in for a while. So what we have out in the lobby, Walter Benenson has arranged a set of ticket that look like this, and I know you can't see except the size of it, but it has a little time circled, and they're arranged in piles out there so you can pick the time that suits you. But if you would pick 10, 10:15, 10:30, what have you, and sort of go at the time the ticket says, it will reduce the problem of everyone needing to stand in a line. It is basically a self-guided tour, and if you just walk to the front door of the laboratory, and there's also a little map on the back that shows you which door to go. I need also to say a word about the issue of radiation. The laboratory is a radiation facility, and if you go there, you'll receive slightly more radiation than if you stay here. One way of quantifying this for you is to compare, for instance, with taking a trip to Colorado. The state of Colorado happens to have a higher level of natural radioactivity than the state of Michigan. Michigan's, in fact, unusually low in the U.S. So taking the tour to the laboratory will be approximately the same as spending 7 hours in Colorado. And nevertheless, in any such situation, it's always better not to receive radiation than to receive it. The reason to receive it is that there will be some positive benefit, and if you think there's a sufficient positive benefit to seeing the laboratory equal to, say, spending 7 hours in Colorado, then that's your reason for taking the trip. Thank you.
Ha ha ha.